First, I'll read a sestina. This is called My Husband, a Dream. We made a trip once to the ocean. What a wealth of water after so much drought. Our home, so dry, seemed a dream to me. The fish that glided by our bodies as we swam, like ocean flowers full of colors, flowers only dream, is still a small oasis. Otherwise, the stillness inside me is like the wild ocean dried, where fish bones dance the sand, full of what love comes to, only so much sorrow. But the sea did hold our bodies then for a time, as though we were a dream it had. And in that time of the sea's dream, we held each other in a certain stillness. We made love slowly like the sea, our bodies and the scent of our bodies like the ocean cleansing itself over and over. How much clarity comes when the waves break, full of white excitement, then the calm, full rest of the sea. I can no longer dream that or lie beside you. Feel how much you strengthened me then, feel your still eyes on me. I think we were the ocean's fools, you and I, our limpid bodies floating at its very edge, its body lulling us to rest upon its full depth. What sort of death is in the ocean's huge blue eye, which closed and dreaming turned us into other beings? I still want that oasis. How we were much too close to the sea's greed, much too willing to believe our bodies. I want even now those still evenings, how close we were to the full pardon of our real lives. A dream. I don't know whose it was, mine or the ocean's. When you died, it was as if the ocean's body emptied, leaving me to dream there was a life beside this sudden stillness. There's a garden sequence in this book, so I'll read a couple from that sequence. This is called Begonia in October, and I think the only thing you need to know about the poem is that it references kohaku, which are little sort of goldfish, kind of koi-esque pond fish that you can winter over. Begonia in October. Stupid blooms. The nights are cold now. Even the kohaku float near the pond's bottom, suspended below the water hawthorn, and do not eat. The wind is stunning. It matters little how long you stand upon the bitter stalks. You will not will away the dull gold leaves or the maple purpling below the stooped pine. Nor, as morning bears its weak light to the walk, will this monotonous palette be made arbitrary, mere backdrop. Little solitary mouths, pink among the inflexible foliage and fat black bees, there is no altering. You will survive. And this is called Stella Doro. Stella Doro are kind of very saturated gold lilies that bloom in June around here. And also, there are bougainvillea referenced in this poem, which actually don't bloom. They don't have normal blooms. Their leaves change color. So that's set at work here, too. Stella Doro. The bougainvillea bloom, not flowers, but leaves change from green to red and scrape the window as they climb from the gray box on rigid twigs, a vining thing that creeps away always from itself, straining towards false flowers. The red leaves drift into air over oaks blown like massive tangled hearts. What good is endurance? Lavandula still mount the terrace. Liatris, dwarf iris, campanula rise and die in beds. The Stella Doro assaults the eye, sun's image, as if in the earth's dull pool it could be mirrored, multiplied along the hedged azalea by a will that marks this world with withering desire. And then maybe one more from this sequence. This is called June Garden, and it's in three sections, short sections. One, lilies tighten in their hard skins in the place where earlier in the cold spring rose terrifying luminescent iris. There, too, the flesh of the tulips, red and purple in their black beds, strained open, stiff, alive, faltering upward into themselves. Two, it is not still. The wind moves, obscured by huge oaks rushing, the maple and ferns bending and torn. Even the oldest, rising over the pitched steeple shift as if taken by a new mind. In the resumed stillness, altered, their unchecked branching. Three, the iris are old now. Twinned brown dugs hang in dried sacks above spired leaves. Dry paper shrivels at each joint. The sun is careless. Beneath fanned begonia, last year's stalks cut short, hide black hollows. Only white flowers in the urn bloom. The wet air bears down. And then maybe one more from this book. This is called Evening Lament. That time of the day when the mind goes blind, not yet twilight. That time of few birds in the air, all small and dark, when the buildings are unsettled and every window is empty. What will the night bring? Why doesn't it come? The sky pales. The bushes turn their backs. Love in the evening, it all leans together. The car on the street against the rising lawn, the bulking home of the old ones against the steep brick houses where the children sleep. Where is the night? Why doesn't it come? Without light, without the thought of it, there is one complete darkness already formed. See the yellow evening, yellow then gray, and the branches becoming more distinct. How brittle the world is in this dull light. How far until night. Now I'm going to read some poems from this new collection. And I'll begin with a couple of poems and end with a poem that is sort of in the same vein as Heidegger's Temple, kind of extending that and more comfortable for me in terms of its voice and approach to the material. But in the middle, there are some poems that where I really set myself a task to alter my approach, have longer lines, a different sort of voice, take up different content. So in the sort of realm of stretching yourself, you know, those poems are not as comfortable, maybe, for me. This is the title poem of the collection, and the first two poems come out of a trip I made to see my daughter in Paris last March. And this is called Inside Such Darkness. On my desk, two postcards. In the first, Canova's marble lovers nearly kiss, and in the other, Kupka's yellow man has just put down his book. He looks at me from two black holes where eyes should be. Such choices, desire or emptiness. That day I'd biked the whole of Paris under a hard, cold sun. Longboats cut the Seine's brown churn as the city rose in scrolled iron, gold, and patinaed surfaces. Wind bit my cheeks. At Notre Dame, multitudes swarmed the concrete parvis. Easter, Christ's passion rose through the many domed interiors I had yet to see. Around me, people in hats, black coats, knits that hid the heads of babies. I thought them love's enactments. Then three arches across the plaza's expanse and three dark portals beneath. Ways of the Mother, the Virgin, the Last Judgment. I don't know which I chose. The Borden Bell tolled its 13 tons in the South Tower. I looked up, saw four stone men, eyes closed above me, men who hold to their hearts what they most cherish, a book, a lyre, a scythe, a scroll, what is reaped, what is offered. Inside such darkness, worlds within worlds, rose windows brooding blood and bruised skies in the transepts, 6 centuries of sorrow, 6 of desire caught in the dark wood and jeweled light, fluttered in the chandeliers. Though I passed under the heights of arches studded with stone reliefs worked tight as curls on a Greek god's head, though the votives wavered their tiny lives of light and the cavernous naves dwarfed the pews, what I stood by so long was a small pane of glass in which Peter, draped in a red robe, sleeps, his hand at his chin, his elbow resting on his knee. Sleep, Peter, I prayed. Sleep the centuries. Sleep the 5 bells of our mother. Close your eyes as we pass by. Desire nothing. Give us nothing. Leave us our emptiness. And this poem is called Gibelet de Mar, and it's in 2 parts, and that French phrase will be made clear in the poem. 1. I saw it first through March sleet, the sky so low Paris was a blur, spread out like lowlands in drifting mist. Tenements, strung wash, rooftops, low domes, equidistant arched windows, and that one bridge over the sun, a wide vigil shaded from taupe to cream, but for the church is a gray monotony, each dome topped by spires tapering infinitely upward, and yet illusion. There is no safe height in this world. My hands were red cold, so I entered below verdigris horses mounted by saints with swords into Sacré-Cœur's arched darkness. A silver virgin with lilies at her feet stood in dim light holding her child hovering in intimate shadows not displaced by devotion. Still persistence licked wood sticks to flame. Votives glimmered like far-off ships on a black sea. Then the singing, then my eyes lifted high to a window filled with pink stars that fell like a jeweled shawl over us all. And I accepted that stillness. I accepted we inhabit faith only for a moment, that it survives us. Past the white altar in the cathedral's gloom, silver angels stretched a gold crown to the heavens. 2. In Le Marais, I ate menteur, slit the top, dipped out sheep's cheese, tasting of butter and earth, drank tea out of a tiny glass. Alone, I ate, watched little birds hop from roof tile to tile as if their furled wings could cut the weather. Elsewhere, sleet swept the Tuileries, then the sun came out. The sky was blue and black by turns. Crazy weather, gibelet de mar, winds from the Atlantic crashing into the mountains, 2 worlds colliding at such height, beyond my power to see or stop or heal. And now to the edgy-voiced, uncomfortable poems. I'll read 3 of these. The first one is called Kant Can't Tuck Point, and of course Immanuel Kant is the father of modern philosophy, and there's some other dead white guys referenced in here too, who you'll recognize. And all of the things in here are true, so you'll get an inkling of what my summer was like. Kant Can't Tuck Point. It's all true. The roofer stuck his foot through, then came rain. Now the ceiling stained and soft, my chimney's falling down. The mailman ripped my box off the house. My house turned sieve, and now my key won't work the door. No, not divorce. It needs a graphite fix. its swollen shut, so moot point. And dare I mention window rot, brick mold gone to hell, the way of all my handy men, my house soft as bread dough. Men, I'm done. I'll be my own man. Stud gun, leveler, my edges honed to fine blades. I'll be lethal, steeped in expertise. Give me the arms of Rafa, legs of an offensive lineman. I eschew Victoria and her secrets. One a body Botticelli made gone hard. No more Derrida or Wordsworth, Aristotle and the boys. Good riddance to the amber dawnlit summits thinking reaches. I'd like to see Kant tuck point the parapet walls. Even my dog has turned on me. Who died unless left him boss of all walks? Side to side, dragging me behind, he snuffles ivy, eats deer dung, spellbound by the world's sense. I should have named him Coleridge for all his headstrong meanderings. But he was on another scent, in search of God and nature, poetry, and all right, praise, I guess. That was his feat and failure, a resolute wish to see the world in all its failings, its ever always state of disrepair, of turning into weightless flakes of ash like those I saw this morning at the curb. And yet, despite all the lost loves and friendship, and through the haze of opium's ether, he held a vision of the world made whole, his work to make us see it. So, okay, I too see a little. Synapse firings or knee-deep in concrete, each worthy work if you can get it. I'll praise the hand that holds the Phillips head, the one that tars the roof. In fact, I honor all who hammer, fit, fix, set fire brick against that burning coming ever towards us, all the hands that unrelentingly and in the midst of this world falling down around us give themselves to work and words that set it right, as if we could. And I guess a disclaimer to the next two poems is if this work at all sort of struggles with mortality and what it means to be human, these next two poems are, I guess, when the good guys don't win. This is called Victory of Vermin. And again, all true. The ants have crawled in my keyboard's keys, hived in the grooved threshold's wood. Their mice are out in the kitchen, frolicking in the dog's paws, passed out as he is on the cold tiles in this late fall heat. I don't blame him. Oblivion has much to recommend it. I lived once in a place with so many roaches they crawled into my coffee, skittered down the walls behind my headboard, barred like I sing of thee. Oh, to all the insects, the rodents we give our daily bread to, hail the exterminator, avoid any death stench in the floorboards. I have my own work here in the center of the universe. Okay, so the community garden thrives on this ecologically sound strata of the give and take of lower life forms, twins to the jerks on the corner crooning past midnight, blathering inebriation's latest tune. It's a rat's ass life down there in the 3-foot brick alleys where the dull knife shines and red eyes see more than their share of all dank trash. Oblivion, there is much to recommend thee. We need those glinty black carapace bodies, hard survivors of eons of extermination, atom bombs, climate change, a glacier or two, and whatever woolly mammoth chose to step on any one of the many gigazillion ancestral homes in the form of dung heap house fodder the tiny marchers carried on their backs to and fro. Survival genes beyond my pea brain petri dish imaginings. Sieg Heil and hail the roach, the rodent, the ant at home in this postmodern keyboard angst of millennial proportion. There are no job qualifications like survival. You're all more fit for the world than me. Have at it. Have all my daily bread. Take every crumb, every bit of gnawed through chocolate bar, soup cracker, green tea. A beast eats anything. Take my every effort at a nuanced life. Take all of it. I'm on call to my only calling, my real boss. I don't know much, but how to dish out the discontent, I'm all in. I'll play my part, grinning hostess to oblivion. And this is a poem Richard selected to publish. So this is the last one of these three kind of angsty poems I'll read. It's called Life, Friends, is Boring. And that, of course, is the first line of one of John Berryman's 77 dream songs. And so the fact that Berryman jumped off a bridge figures into this poem, as well as the sort of oblique reference to Hart Crane falling off an ocean liner. I think just the 77 dream songs and the fact that Berryman figures into this would be enough to understand it. It's called Life, Friends, is Boring. So why not say so? I know those moments, waking, thinking, Jesus, not this again. It's in the job description, being human. The bard speaks of it, Berryman, the other bard, likewise. But the jumping, what is with all this jumping off things? Bridges, ocean liners. Listen, one night I stood at the sink in the dark in my before-bed angst, leaning at the white square's rim, peering over the edge, so to speak, and out from between my feet came this tiny little black mouse with enormous ears, would have fit in the palm of my hand. One look at the gargantuan me sent it flying down the dark hall into the waiting jaws of my cat, now deceased, since we're on the subject. She pranced around carrying that terrified bit of flesh, mewling and growling. And since we are all hardwired first responders, there I am with the dustpan lunging this way and that, dodging cat claws. Finally, I get the little thing into the dustpan, slip a bowl over it, race down the steps, out the door, set free the little dark into the larger dark. And that thing raced right back in through the crack in the brick, took the express up to my place, and before I was in situ at the sink, there it was under the pipes. Go figure. Death wish. It's everywhere. And always we're saying, no way. And then, Jesus, not this again. We should just make up our minds. But there is no need for jumping. The thing with jumping is that you have an infinite amount of time in which to review events, and isn't avoidance of this the raison d'etre for the great leap of faith in the first place? Enough said. I need some lunch, food for thought, all that verisimilitude. That's the thing in the end. Make it seem like a life. And before you come back from the yard, the mine's basement, lunch, poof, there, by golly, there it is. And the whole thing starts over again. And there's nothing really but that. No matter how many dreams or songs about dreams, we torture ourselves singing. Okay, two more poems. There's a little section in this collection about my family, which I've resisted writing about forever. And so I'll read one of those. And this is about my father's death. It's called As Is My Due. Who am I, Lord, that I should try so hard to write this? Really, I ask you for the 100th, for the 1,000th time, what are the words with which to name my sin, and who am I to utter them? That day I buried my father, he'd asked to have a rabbi speak his service. It was miraculous we found one. My father never saw the inside of a synagogue, not in my lifetime. My brother, too, he spoke. He spoke beautifully, as he does all things. I said not one word, not one. The coffin, draped with a flag, closed. The rabbi read some poem I don't remember. I dressed my mother in her cropped red jacket, sat her on the toilet seat, then pulled on nylons, a skirt, put her in a wheelchair. She smiled. I think she cried and smiled, her face vacant. They folded the flag and put it in her lap, played taps. It was those trips I made to see him at the last, when he was dying. I knew it, he knew it, but we never once spoke it. I drove 6 hours home singing to drown out, but still I heard you. What you asked was how a life worked hard as this one, how could it end this way? Wife gone to madness, appetite gone, sleepless, poor, the body eating itself. I have no words for that. You cooked your breakfast, stooped at the stove, never having made a meal. I couldn't bear to watch. I turned my back, my love made cowardly. That sin, now, I name it, as I will always name it. There are no other words. And the last poem I'll read is called Rain, back to my more comfortable voice, I think. And it's in two parts. Rain. One. There is a pack of wild dogs in the park. I saw their kill, fox blood, and the remains. One dog lies in view, gold and humble, approachable, long in the tall grass by the water tower, close to the woods, beneath gargoyles, crouched at the tower eaves, while the others, the ugly ones, mill among the trees and wait. They are smart and still, or at least quiet, placid, calm as water, calm and soft as rain. I dreamed this rain in the night, how it fell straight down among the trees, touching nothing, how it felt, how it tasted of emptiness, and welcoming somehow. In the dream, it was desirable to walk in its warmth, to hear the comfort in it, but to be completely untouched as the gargoyles looked down, gray, hunched, and silent in the rain, witnessing, sitting high at the four corners, full of wisdom. The art of dreaming is a separateness, an isolation we don't bear into the world, which is why I did not see the wild dogs, even the inoffensive one, the one who might have been made of stone in the real world. Two. In the park, there is an old bent man made of cast iron with no shoes, a man in a headdress holding a cormorant over a black cast iron basket woven to look like reed. His intent eyes and attentive cocked head suggest his love for the bird, but the hands are full of wrath. His left hand, gentling the bird's back, lies softly along the hardened feathers. But the right hand grips the throat where a fish struggles, and that hand is hard, and the bird is stiff and staring like a fox caught in the mouth of a wild dog. And nothing struggles, nothing thrashes or strives. Not the bird, not the gold dog in the grass by the tower, not the fox or the man gripping the cormorant, not the cormorant who must sacrifice a hard-earned prey and nearly starve to death. Not one labors and the rain comes down and touches nothing. And beyond sight, wildness grows impatient in the darkening wood, an unseen hunger which is the mystery of the world, though among the rest of us, all is sculpted, cast hard as iron, still as the mind of God, beneath the wind which keens over the long grass, passes over the bent man's hands and cannot save the bird. Over the river, the hollow call of stone continues singing. Thank you.